Today in Studio 360, we ask you for suggestions for some additional American icons. This one we couldn't resist.
J.R. Ewing always keeps his promises.
You're not a human being. You're scum!
I'm really a nice fella when I get what I want.
Why is the super fabulous ultra 1980s soap opera Dallas still airing all over the world?
You know, everyone believed that's the American reality, that everything is shiny, glamorous.
Rich people behaving badly. That's our next American icon, the People's Choice. Plus, what's the matter with Kansas this time? As public arts funding dries up all over the country, Kansas has become the first state to try to abolish its arts commission. We'll talk to a state senator there who's fighting back, a Republican state senator. I'm Kurt Anderson. That's all ahead in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And today we'll ask whether Dallas, not the city, but the 80s TV show about rich and beautiful ugly Americans, was in fact a cleverly disguised piece of communist propaganda. That is the latest installment in our series on American icons. But we'll begin today with a look at government budgets. We all know we're in a big hole, and as legislators, state and federal, look for cuts, one item seems to keep coming up: the arts and culture. In the budget he presented last week, President Obama proposes reducing the National Endowment for the Arts budget. But the Republicans in the House want to go all the way and eliminate every bit of funding for the NEA. Full disclosure, the NEA does provide a tiny piece of Studio 360's budget. To give you some context, the administration wants $146 million for the National Endowment for the Arts. The Army's budget just for its military bands is $195 million. But arts funding is probably even more endangered in the states. Several of them, including Texas and Michigan, are talking about eliminating their state arts commissions. But last week, Kansas got there first. Governor Sam Brownback, who's a Republican, issued an executive order shutting down the Kansas Arts Commission. Its budget is around $600,000 a year. But not every Republican is out to cut arts funding. We found a state senator from Kansas, State Senator Roger Reitz, who thinks that blowing up the Arts Commission is both bad for Kansas culture and bad economic development policy.
The Kansas nonprofit arts sector is a $153.3 million industry, which supports over 4,000 jobs and generates over $15 million in state and local government revenues.
It really sounds almost like, to me, like the definition of cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Exactly. The loss of the Kansas Arts Commission totals a loss to the state of over $1.2 million each year. And without funding from the state to match the federal dollars, one-to-one, Kansas loses $778,000.
Now, you've got a little less than 2 months to pass a resolution in the legislature to override this executive order.
That's right. We need 21 votes. There's 40 people in the Senate. I have 21 people who have told me they would vote for it.
Really?
But there's going to be some things coming back and forth, I'm sure, from the governor's office trying to peel off some of those folks. I just hope that those are going to be one-to-one votes, that they'll look me in the eye and say they'll continue with it.
Now, like my late Republican parents from Nebraska, where I grew up, you're a Republican in this very Republican state, fighting for the arts. You're a doctor. You didn't have a life in the arts. Why is this important to you?
Well, it's a quality issue with regards to the state of Kansas. I mean, the things that make things good about our experience as we live through our lives is the neat things that people can do that have incredible talents and qualities are the things that distract us in a favorable way in which we feel good about ourselves and marvel at the quality of art that these folks can bring to our attention, and particularly if they're done by local artists. I'm in a position now to make that thing happen, and I'll take a good deal of fulfillment from that effort.
Will you also take, is there a political cost to you, do you think?
No, I don't think so. Not in any way, shape, or form. The Gary County is mostly an agricultural area, but they've recently developed a new art center there, and they also have developed a new opera house it's actually a renovation of an opera house that came to their attention at the turn of the century, the last century. Again, makes those people feel good about themselves.
Right.
So I've bought into this hook, line, and sinker.
Good for you. And you don't think the Tea Party types who call you a Republican in name only are going to get fodder out of this?
I've been called that, and it doesn't bother me a bit. I'm going to stay right where I am.
I wanted to play a little bit of a speech by one of the great Kansans, President Eisenhower.
Yes.
Just to this issue. We can listen.
Sure.
On this, the quarter century mark of the Museum of Modern Art, there is a reminder to all of us of an important principle that we should ever keep in mind. This principle is that freedom of the arts is a basic freedom, one of the pillars of liberty in our land.
So there's Ike Eisenhower talking about the precious freedom of the arts, which, by the way, is on the Kansas Arts Commission's homepage. Now, I understand we're at a time of belt tightening and tough choices, but how has arts funding in general become such a boogeyman for conservatives?
I mull that same question over in my own mind a lot, and I don't exactly know how to answer that question. I'm concerned that we mixed up things that are expedient and politically expedient, particularly, with things that are good and represent. You know, St. Paul said, you know, hold fast to that which is good. I've never forgot that phrase in the Bible. That's in Romans. And when you think of it that way, then you've got something good. Don't throw it away. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yep.
But bottom line is, we don't have to go this way. Kansas is better than that.
And we're talking, by the way, about things like summer youth theaters and children's choirs. You know, not
all of that.
Avant-garde,
all of that.
Objectionable art.
And these issues that are so important to me are all things that are going to go away permanently.
Right.
Once it's gone forever. And we're sitting right on the edge of the precipice watching it. I've got to have these 21 votes. I've told people I'm going to get to it no matter what. I'm going to keep working at it.
Carry on my wayward son. There'll be peace when you are done. Lay your weary head to rest. Don't you cry no more.
Roger Reitz represents District 22 in the Kansas State Senate, and we will be watching his fight. Consider this. Reality is a cliche from which we escape by metaphor. Whoa, did your mind explode too? The line is from the poet Wallace Stevens, and it's the quote that opens a new book called I Is an Other, The Secret Life of Metaphor and How It Shapes the Way We See the World. The author, James Geary, is obsessed with metaphor, and not mainly as a literary device, but how we all use metaphor every day in conversation and how it actually defines the ways we think. James Geary, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
So the title of your book is I Is an Other, which is a phrase that was new to me, which proves I'm not familiar enough with my French symbolist poets. Explain the title and what it says about metaphor.
Well, I Is an Other is a quote from Arthur Rimbaud, a 19th century French poet. And he was a strong believer in metaphor as the ultimate vehicle for poetry. I use it as a sort of equation for what metaphor is, because metaphor equates one thing with another thing. And by equating it with that, it's a sort of paradox of metaphor. We describe what something is by equating it with something that it's not.
And what your book makes clear is that our conversation in a daily basis is rife with metaphor. We're like the character Molière who said, I didn't realize I've been speaking in prose all these years. But if you say, I feel blue or I'm blue, you're engaging in metaphor. If you say she's hot or if you say it's raining cats and dogs or any number of things that we all say, we are addicted to metaphor without knowing.
That's right. There's whenever we talk about anything abstract or conceptual, or we try to get across an idea or express our emotions, we inevitably and instinctively use metaphors. Because when we're describing these things that are sort of immaterial, we cannot describe them directly. We have to describe them indirectly. And often the metaphorical description is much more vivid than a sort of bland, much more literal description.
So instead of describing something abstract like the economy, we don't say certain metrics indicate that sales are greater and unemployment is higher. We say the economy is booming or the economy is cratering, both of which are metaphors.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, economics is the ultimate numbers game, but it is just saturated with metaphors. And in fact, I use the word saturated. Most of the metaphors we use for the economy are related to liquid, fluid dynamics.
Yes.
We talk about revenue streams. We talk about being solvent and liquidity. And that conveys the function of money in a much clearer and more vivid way than trying to describe it abstractly. But the downside, which is another metaphor, sorry about that, but the side effect of that is that the metaphors that we use, they're psychoactive. They have profound and very subtle psychological effects.
Does that mean we get high on metaphors?
I do, but I think I might be extreme in that regard. What I mean is, if we stick with the economics example, if you think back to the subprime mortgage crisis when house prices were described as soaring, climbing, leaping, and there's some fascinating studies been done that people have been exposed to this kind of financial commentary, and those people had much higher expectations that those trends would continue in the future. Why? Because these metaphors trigger unconscious associations with living things, things that can literally climb and literally soar. This is not to say, you know, that metaphors caused the subprime mortgage crisis. But when metaphors like that become pervasive, they do create a sort of psychological frame through which people start viewing that issue. You know, sometimes that's okay, but sometimes it's not okay, and we need to be aware of it.
One of the things that your book reminded me of, a sort of pet peeve of mine, the ubiquity of people misusing the word literally. Oh, I was literally dying in there. Or, you know, all these absolutely non-literal things, which increases this confusion that you're talking about between the metaphorical and the real.
Yes. Again, it's metaphors just kind of filled with these weird paradoxes. You know, people use the word literally metaphorically, and it's really bizarre.
Whoa.
But it goes to show
you're blowing
you,
my mind, James.
It goes to show you, though, just how, you know, like you said, ubiquitous and pervasive metaphor is.
Yeah.
And what I find really interesting is even literal statements, and I mean literal in the literal, not the metaphorical sense, even factual statements are metaphors. A famous line from John Donne, no man is an island.
Yeah.
So if someone says that to you, you think, yeah, of course no man is an island. You know, no man is a rock either or a tree. But that's a factual statement, but we immediately understand its metaphorical significance as well.
Right. The book also made me realize, you know, people think, oh, metaphor is what artists and writers do. But in fact, when there's a high density of metaphor in a given piece of writing, I more often than not, I realize, think it's bad writing.
That's right.
Which is kind of counterintuitive.
That's right.
You know, if you say raining cats and dogs or get under my skin or all those things in a sequence, you go, you know, think of a fresh way to say something, dude.
That's exactly right. First of all, you should the cliches were once not cliches.
Yes.
So
the first time somebody said it's raining cats and dogs, that was amazing.
That was totally amazing. Think of a phrase like the Iron Curtain.
Right.
You know, when Churchill first said that, it was an incredibly powerful metaphor.
Yeah.
And cliches become cliches because in the beginning they were so damn good. It's sort of like a pop song. You just hear it every day, five times a day, and, you know, after a while you start hating it. But that's another paradox of metaphor. The more successful a metaphor becomes, in other words, the more cliche it becomes, the more we mistake it for literal truth.
Yeah.
So, for example, when I say, Kurt, I see what you mean, the verb see is a metaphor because, you know, I don't. When I'm listening to you, I don't see anything, and right now I can't even see you or on the radio. But why does every language around the world have the same metaphor? I see what you mean. Seeing equals knowing. Well, it has to do with the way our bodies are. We take in most of our information through our eyes. So as we kind of evolve to start, you know, in the beginning we're just dealing with sort of physical, factual, visual information. But as we started evolving and started getting into abstract intellectual information, we carried over the verb for seeing to represent knowing, which is metaphorically seeing and understanding.
It seems what you're saying, one of the things you're saying, and I agree with you if you are, is that we should simply not be so unthinking about seeing the difference between metaphor and a hard fact. And whether in our speaking, in our writing, and inevitably in our thinking, that kind of blurring of those lines can actually be a little dangerous.
Mm-hmm. I agree totally. And George Orwell wrote a wonderful essay, Why I Write, and in it he talks about metaphor and the appropriate use of metaphor. And he decries the use of cliché, like you were saying earlier, like things like Iron Fist and the dustbin of history, because it's lazy. If you use clichés, it sort of absolves you of the need to think and write for yourself.
Yes.
So what he urges is that we create our own metaphors and create it afresh, and because that it's through that kind of fresh thinking that we really engage, and through that we can think critically and speak critically and write critically.
Well, one of the ubiquitous business metaphors of the last 30 years, let's think outside the box, has become almost the very emblem of not thinking outside the box because it's such a tiresome cliche.
Yeah, I mean, you hear a phrase like that and you just want to throw up. So,
yeah.
But again, it's the sort of perverse power of metaphor. The wrong metaphor is such a turnoff that it immediately shuts a person down. But the right metaphor really can spark things off.
James Geary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Geary's book is called I Is an Other, The Secret Life of Metaphor and How It Shapes the Way We See the World.
Hiding in my room, safe within my womb, I touch no one and no one touches me.
Coming up.
Now listen here, little brother.
No, I won't listen.
It's the show that defined a certain image of Texas and of America.
You know, everyone believed that's the American reality, that everything is shiny, glamorous.
Dallas. That's next up in our series on American icons. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
If you ever get the chance to go to Dallas, take it from me.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion offers options that let everyone express his or her creativity to customize their car to fit their lives. Creativity begins at Scion.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Last year, we aired a new season of American Icons shows, our series about great works of art and culture that tell us who we are as Americans. We covered the autobiography of Malcolm X, I Love Lucy, and a bunch of others. And as we wrapped up the series, we asked you what you thought should be declared an American icon. We got lots of great ideas, including one we just couldn't pass up. Laura Dietrich, who lives in Pittsburgh, suggested the TV show Dallas, which ran from 1978 to 1991 on CBS.
I remember how these otherwise very serious adults in my life were getting so obsessive about a TV show.
Laura, you're in luck. The cable channel TNT has just greenlit a pilot for a new series called Dallas: Changing of the Guard. It's about the next generation to swill and spend and overdress and sleep their way around South Fork Ranch. Meanwhile, the original Dallas is still playing in many countries around the world. Julia Barton grew up in Dallas, Texas, while the show was on the air 20 and 30 years ago, and she will help us unpack this American icon.
7 years is a long time, J.R., and there's nothing wrong with me.
Over the holidays, I was back home in Dallas, watching Dallas with two friends. I've known Jennifer since kindergarten.
Where are you going?
You better stop drinking, Sue Ellen. There's nothing uglier than a woman can't handle her liquor.
Yeah, like anybody would really care if someone had a drunk wife in Dallas.
All right, darling. I'll buy you a puppy.
This is episode 10 from the first season. It's called Black Market Baby. Okay, JR hasn't touched his wife, Sue Ellen, in like 7 years, and Bobby's wife was going to have a baby 5 episodes ago, but then JR accidentally, on purpose, pushed her off the hayloft and she lost the baby. Now she might try again to get pregnant, so Sue Ellen decides if she can't have the first baby, she'll just buy one. So she goes to meet the birth mom in a bad neighborhood in Dallas, and this is why we're watching. My friend Jennifer and her brother got to be extras.
Oh, there I am. That's me.
We see the back of Jennifer's head. She's in a shopping cart being pushed by her brother.
Totally saw Vance. Vance is like staring.
Vance was 7 and Jennifer was 9 when this aired in 1978. Their dad worked as a key grip on the local set of Dallas.
I guess mostly I cared about the chuck wagon. There's a guy that sat in there all day long, and his job was to cook whatever you wanted for everybody on the set, anything you wanted, as much as you wanted. And I must have ate like 2 pounds of bacon that day because I love bacon.
Of course, most of the time, Dallas was filmed in California. But we in the Sun Belt got more out of it than just bacon. It showed us as powerful, ruthless, in charge. Our moment was beginning. Dallas foretold and glorified not just the Reagan Revolution, but all kinds of huge changes that have made America what it is now. Not that CBS was thinking about any of that when it commissioned the show. They just wanted a saga. Those were big days for TV sagas.
The word saga to me meant Texas, which I had driven through once in my entire life.
That's David Jacobs. The Hollywood studio Lorimar hired him to come up with a scenario. Jacobs got the Ewing name from a billboard he'd seen on that drive through Texas. He gave them a Cain and Abel story, pitting Bobby, who looked so handsome with his shirt off, as it often was, against the mean older J.R.
He's taken over his father's empire. He's probably multiplied its worth 10 times, has more money and power than his father ever had, and yet his younger brother is still his father's favorite.
And the Ewings have a Romeo and Juliet-style feud with a rival clan, the Barneses. Bobby marries a Barnes, and J.R. will never forgive him.
Now, listen here, little brother.
No, I won't listen. And you can stop that little brother nonsense, too, because that stops from here on in.
Hold on.
We'll always be brothers, J.R. But if you ever try and force me to choose, there's not a chance in a million I'd choose you or any family above my wife.
David Jacobs' concept for the show had nothing to do with Dallas, Texas, till he sent it to a studio executive.
He said it was fine, but I changed the name. And I said, well, what did you call it? He said, Dallas. And I said, what do you mean Dallas? I don't know that this is set in Dallas. He said, well, it sounded good to me. It sounded better than Houston.
Poor Houston. They're the ones with the oil, and Fort Worth has the cattle. Dallas had bankers, insurance brokers, and technology geeks. And they didn't wear cowboy hats.
Nobody wants to be country here. That's why the people in the real country hate Dallas.
Did you ever see Dallas from a BC-9 at night?
Jim Schutz writes a column for the Dallas Observer called Get Off My Lawn. He came here the same year that the TV show started, when the city was more associated with JFK than JR.
When I came to Dallas in 78, there was a guy at the Dallas Morning News who was still covering the assassination in 78. But his job was to write about conspiracy theories, sort of enthusiastically, because Dallas was eager to discover any theory by which it was somebody else's fault. Russians, the mafia, just somebody who wasn't Dallas.
Well, Dallas is a rich man with a death wish in his eyes. A steel and concrete soul, no war.
Texan Jimmy Dale Gilmore picked up on that Dallas hint of menace and shame even before Hollywood did. But then Hollywood took J.R., the bad man who just didn't care what people thought, and made him the hero.
It made Dallas, which was this grouchy, adding machine kind of actuarial city, look kind of cool and romantic. So Dallas then embraced the myth and in some ways became like the TV show.
Rebranded and set free. That's the Dallas I remember. We could not build malls and skyscrapers fast enough. We could not perm our hair out big enough. We threw up subdivisions of giant houses with big chandeliers and enormous foyers. We hurled forth megaton versions of J.R., H. Ross Perot, George W. Bush. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Because it was so successful in that second season, CBS asked Dallas to do 4 additional shows.
David Jacobs, the creator of Dallas.
They already had their cliffhanger. And somebody, and nobody knows whether it was Camille Marchetta, who was the story editor, or some people say it was Art Lewis, who was the producer, but somebody said, let's shoot the son of a bitch.
That was the spring of 1980. By summer, Larry Hagman was on the cover of Time. The November 1980 episode of Dallas, the one that revealed JR's would-be assassin, remains the most viewed hour of television ever. More than 350 million people tuned in worldwide. The bullets hardly slowed JR down. By then, he was everywhere.
Every place that JR stomps is a section of neighbor's fence. He softly walks and gently talks and never leaves tracks in the land. But old JR has gone real far on the backs of his fellow man. JR! Who do you think you are? JR! You're pushing for super!
It wasn't just JR that made the show popular. It was the glamorous lifestyle, the giant swimming pools. And the people who fell for it the hardest were those who didn't know any better. People like Yock Kilmy, living in drab apartment blocks behind the Iron Curtain.
All these Soviet-Estonian living rooms look the same. We had the same cupboards, same sofas. Brown, of course. What color do you expect a Soviet sofa to be?
Kilmy grew up in Soviet Estonia. Dallas was banned, of course. But Kilmy's dad, lots of dads in Estonia, built converters to get TV signals from Finland. His mom would translate the subtitles from Finnish into Estonian every Friday night.
I remember these Saturday mornings or Saturday nights when the last episode of Dallas were discussed over and over again.
Kilmy's made a documentary film. It's about how shows like Dallas weakened the hold of communism.
You know, everyone believed that that's the American reality. People wanted to believe that, you know, people live in skyscrapers and have beautiful cars and everything is shiny and glamorous.
Kilmy's not the only one who thinks this kind of dynamic made shows like Dallas into a geopolitical force. Matt Welch is the editor of the magazine Reason.
We should celebrate these kind of semi-vulgar pop culture things and understand that people adapt and use them and create their own cultural artifacts that are inspired by them in a way that inexorably leads towards human liberation. And that's a good thing.
It's not that Dallas ended the Cold War, but Welch cites the case of Romania. The dictator Nicolae Ceausescu allowed Dallas to be shown on state TV, thinking it was a critique of American capitalism. Oops.
Nu știu cum s-a întâmplat asta, sincer, pentru că pe vremea aia noi aveam...
That's Rodica Florea. I met her near the city of Slobozia. She says in the last days of Romanian socialism, they had only 2 hours of TV a day, and half of that was news propaganda. So Dallas was a big deal.
Lady! Hai, fătiță, haide!
Florea now manages Parcul Vacant Hermes, a hotel and ranch complex. I've heard it referred to as South Forkescu. The stables are filled with ponies, a horse, and puppies. A local tycoon named Ili Alexandru built this place. He wanted to be the JR of Romania. He dressed in a cowboy hat, cowboy boots, the whole thing. Here in the middle of farmland, he tried to build a replica of South Fork Ranch. He lined a long driveway with trees. He built an extra mansion in the back with an 8-car garage.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. That's huge. He was building a lot of things all at once, huh?
The JR of Romania ended up in prison for a variety of financial crimes. While in jail, he told a newspaper, quote, "I admire JR, but I was like Bobby. The Bobby inside me finished me."
Oh, Dallas, you shine with an evil light. How'd you turn a billion?
Even at the real South Fork Ranch, the one outside Dallas, people seem puzzled why the show has so much traction.
I keep thinking, well, maybe no one will come next year. That's not the case. We do 11 tours a day.
Adele Taylor is a tour guide here. She tells us all the tricks the TV crew and actors use to make South Fork look huge, especially the pool.
You would see them dive off of the board. They would swim away, and then they swam out of the frame of the camera, so they were gone. And they were down at the other end, we thought, of that long, long pool.
The pool, of course, is tiny. The long driveway, not so long. The house is smaller than a 90s McMansion. The illusion is what strikes everyone who visits here. but it's the illusion that we've bought for so long, that we, like Ewing Oil, will keep getting bigger and wealthier forever. Jim Schutz says that Dallas, Texas bought the myth and became more like the show. Just check out the new Cowboys Stadium if you want to know what he means. But it's not just Dallas, Texas. We all bought the myth.
En Afrique, c'est presque tout le monde qui aime Bobby. On n'aime pas JR là-bas. On dit qu'il est méchant.
On my tour of South Fork, I met Simon Ntobi. He's from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now he lives here in Dallas. For him, the show is all about the American dream.
American dream is not true, is not also false.
Not true, but also not false.
It depends to what you want to do. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, when I came in America, I didn't have money. You know what I'm saying? I think only $5.
Dallas gave Simon the heads up that the American dream would be kind of brutal and competitive, with no one looking out for the weak.
In French, that song, they say, Dallas, malheur à celui qui n'a pas compris la vie. Donc, malheur à celui qui n'a pas compris la vie. You understand? Yeah.
Bad luck to he who does not understand. One day he could lose his life. Somewhere in the world right now, the original show is still airing, teaching more people about our cycles of boom and bust, our desperate housewives and scheming tycoons. But it's not broadcast in America anymore. We know the story too well. We all live in Dallas now. For Studio 360, I'm Julia Barton.
It might not be long before Dallas 2.0 is on American screens after all. The cable channel TNT has a pilot in the works for a Dallas sequel. You can check out all 24 of the American icons in our series, from Moby Dick to Superman, at our website, our spectacularly new and improved website, studio360.org. When we asked you all for nominations for the next American icon, some of John Steinbeck's novels were among your suggestions, which I was glad to see because Steinbeck's reputation hasn't held up quite as well as maybe it should have. 50 years ago, Steinbeck began his last major book, Travels with Charlie in Search of America. It was about a road trip he took, pretty much a huge loop around the United States in a camper truck with his dog, Charlie. Over the next few weeks, we're revisiting some stops in Travels with Charlie to look at how America has changed in the half century since. We started in Sag Harbor, New York, and today we're in New Orleans, where Steinbeck saw for himself one of the most dramatic events of the last century in progress, the racial integration of public schools.
We're in the Faubourg Marigny area of New Orleans. It's immediately across the street from the French Quarter. We're sitting in Washington Park. It's a one square block green space in one corner, swings and things for children. And what you hear in the background are school children who are here.
It's hard to imagine that anybody would want all of these kids to fail, or some of these kids to fail, or any of these kids to fail. But if all of the young people in this park graduated from high school in 5 years, all of them could not work in New Orleans, commensurate with their education.
This is my story.
My name is Kalamu Yasalam.
This is my song.
I am a writer, educator, and filmmaker.
I will sing these here blues, though they done stole my tongue.
Yeah, in 1960, when Steinbeck came through, I was born in 1947. I was 13 years old. He came to look at France school and what was happening there. And France was an elementary school where integration, what some people would say forced integration, was going on.
Late in 1960, Steinbeck wrote, the incident most reported and pictured in the newspapers was the matriculation of a couple of tiny Negro children in a New Orleans school.
New Orleans school. Behind these small, dark mites were the law's majesty and the law's power to enforce. Both the scales and the sword were allied with the infants, while against them were 300 years of fear and anger and terror of change in a changing world.
This bitter earth, well, what the fruit it bears.
When France happened, the school I went to, Rivers Frederick Jr. High School, was located in the 7th Ward. I lived in the lower 9th Ward. In order to get to school, I would catch a bus, the Galvez bus. And the Galvez bus passed right in front of France School. So we saw what was going on there. And one of the guys that rode the bus with us was in the band. And for about a week, instead of carrying a trombone in his case, he carried a shotgun because it had become just that dangerous.
What made the newsmen love the story?
What made the newsmen love the story was a group of stout, middle-aged women who, by some curious definition of the word mother, gathered every day to scream invectives at children. No newspaper had printed the words these women shouted, but now I heard the words, bestial and filthy and degenerate. These were not mothers, not even women. They were crazy actors playing to a crazy audience.
To a crazy audience. Steinbeck is doing what many of us do. When we see something that we find horrific, first thing we do is dehumanize it. And the second thing we do is pretend it's not us. When the truth is that one major part of the human condition is the ability to be inhuman. And all humans have that within them. And we must struggle with that.
We're walking on Frenchman towards the river.
I was born by the river.
The river that way! I believe that this country has made tremendous legal developments. There's a big difference between segregation being legal and segregation being illegal. Is that big difference addressing the problem? No. Here's a soundbite for you. Race was never the problem in America. That was a symptom of the problem. The problem was the economic appropriation and exploitation of land and labor. Those who owned never intended to share. And so instead of sharing, what they did was told you, then black people's your problem.
Sometimes you start something and it stops.
So I did this album called My Story, My Song. It's a series of duets with New Orleans musicians whom I knew. Walter Washington, who was a blues musician, who was playing tonight on Frenchman Street, the street we just passed.
This is called Unfinished Blues.
This is John Steinbeck, travels with Charlie in search of America. He set off with a dog going looking for America. I don't know if he found it.
I have not intended to present, nor do I think I have presented, any kind of cross-section so that a reader can say, he thinks he has presented a true picture of the South. I don't. I've only told what a few people said to me and what I saw. I don't know whether they were typical or whether any conclusion can be drawn. But I do know it is a troubled place and a people caught in a jam. And I know that the solution, when it arrives, will not be easy or simple.
That's a passage from John Steinbeck's 1960 book, Travels with Charlie in Search of America. It was read by John Biewen of the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, who produced this series. You can watch a video about his documentary project at studio360.org. Coming up, we have a piece of advice. Stop dithering and get to work.
if you wait for the clouds to part and for you to be struck in the head with a bolt of lightning, you're liable to wait for the rest of your life.
Words of wisdom from some of America's most successful creative people in our brand new book, Spark: How Creativity Works. That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Over the last few weeks, it has been fun revisiting some of the great moments from the first decade of Studio 360. It's not just a nostalgic wallow. I've been discussing what we've learned over these 10 years about creativity with Julie Burstein, who was the show's executive producer for many years. She's put together the first Studio 360 book. It's called Spark: How Creativity Works, and it's being published this week. Last week, we talked about how artists use their work to deal with life's inevitable tough times. Julie is with me again, and we are on to something both more upbeat and kind of nuts and boltsy, yes?
Yes. Today, we're going to talk about work, which is something that a lot of us avoid, and we're going to hear how these artists actually do it. But the work itself doesn't start when you sit down at a desk. There's what my mom likes to call the work before the work. I know for me, I had to completely reorganize my tiny attic office before I could even start writing Spark. And it reminded me of the conversation you had a couple of years ago with Yo-Yo Ma when he described what he does each morning before he really gets down to practicing. Before he asks his cello named Petunia to sing, he really has to warm her up.
I've become friends with the instrument. Uh-huh. I try not to tax it too much. It's really like warming up a car or warming up your body. You stretch it.
Uh-huh.
You don't go into a fast run. You don't take it to 60 in 3 seconds or whatever. Because every day, the humidity is different. And wood, as well as our bodies, are slightly different. And it's actually making that relationship happen. And I think that's the most important thing, because if you don't have that happen, everything's going to be frustrating.
Warming up, which probably all creative people do, or all people do in one way or another, is great. But then, of course, there are so many ways to procrastinate. Oh, I should check my email. Oh, I should check that fact I may use. The novelist Isabel Allende was here, and she, interestingly, has a sort of macro technique to make her begin a new book. And that is, she begins every novel she writes on the same day, January 8th.
Because if I don't start on January 8th, I will probably not write it. But I'm still doubting about what that book will be about. Can you imagine what January 7th is like in my life?
It's interesting how a creative ritual can border on the OCD.
Well, sometimes I think you may have to call on those parts of yourself to be able to get any work done. And when Chuck Close was here, he talked about how his student work was all over the place, very abstract, and he really didn't have a process. But when it came time to paint his big self-portrait, which really launched his career, he used a grid to break down the large image into smaller parts, and that was incredibly useful for him as a process.
I wanted to have something very specific to do every day, and I wanted to do today what I did yesterday, and tomorrow I'll do what I do today. So I found a way to break down a big, complicated image into a lot of small, bite-sized pieces.
He has, accordingly, a great saying about creative work. He says, inspiration is for amateurs and the rest of us just show up and get to work.
If you wait for the clouds to part and for you to be struck in the head with a bolt of lightning, you're liable to wait for the rest of your life. But if you simply get going, something will occur to you.
By the way, listeners, play that again and again from our website. I think that's the most perfect description of how creative work gets done than almost any I've ever heard.
But one thing that happens, I think, inevitably to everyone is you get to a point where you can't work any longer, where something is going wrong. And the sculptor Richard Serra told a story of working in his studio when he was just starting out in New York City. His assistant was Phil Glass.
That is Philip Glass, the famous composer.
Exactly, who was working as a plumber at that point, writing music and working with Richard Serra. And every afternoon, they would hit what he calls the 4 o'clock problem, where they just couldn't keep going. And so this is what they did.
We'd get on the ferry or we'd get on a subway because we found that if we took ourselves out of the studio and got into a space where you didn't have to walk and you were being transported, that actually ideas were exchanged more rapidly. So we used to take ferry boat rides. Sounds strange, but we did. Or we used to get on the subway and just ride back and forth and then go back to the studio just to get ourselves in a different mindset.
Kurt, what do you do when you hit the 4 o'clock problem?
Well, and my 4 o'clock problem often comes at 2:30 or 3. Maybe I'm on Central Time.
You're
still
a little early, right?
But, you know, it, depending on the day, a nap. Or depending on the day, I can come here and try to make radio as well and get and give up.
But diversion is an essential piece, just getting away from it.
Exactly, because you get so – you start breathing your own fumes and you get caught in your own little piece of paper or screen you're staring at.
So we've heard about beginnings and middles. What about endings? I remember – years ago, we did a show on how do you know when it's done,
right.
And your guest was
Tony Kushner, the writer of the great Angels in America, who had then just put on his lovely musical play, Caroliner Change, and he told me that he and his creative team had just a hell of a time finally coming up with the perfect ending.
Yes, he struggled and struggled with director George Wolfe and with the composer Janine Tesori and the star Tonya Pinkins, who plays Caroline. They did like 16 different versions of this song, and they had one big blow up. And afterwards, Kushner was on a subway platform, and he called George Wolfe and he said, "Okay, I'm going to write something that includes everybody's ideas." And Wolfe said, "No, I want you to go home and forget everything that everybody said. You're the only one who's going to nail this for the words. Do your version." So Kushner did, and then brought it to the composer Janine Tesori.
And I think literally within an hour, it was set to music. We played it for ourselves. We both knew immediately that's it. Tanya learned it in like 2 seconds. She's a very fast study. And that night, the audience, when she finished, screamed, and we thought, okay, so it's done. And it works. And when it works, it works.
That's like, you know, 42nd Street or a
movie. Yeah, it was a little bit like 42nd. It felt really good. I felt like a real Tin Pan Alley, songwriter.
Mm-mm. Hope and water turned to wine. Hope's fine. Hope's fine. Hope's fine. Jelly turned to mud and some folks go to school at night.
Julie, thanks very much for coming back today.
My pleasure.
Studio 360's first book is just out, and it's called Spark: How Creativity Works. We'd love to hear from you about how you get back to work when you're feeling less than inspired. What do you do when you hit the wall at 4 o'clock? Tell us about it at studio360.org. And while you're there, you can listen to the full interviews with the geniuses in the book. Two weeks ago in our Spark conversation, we gave you all a challenge. We wanted to see you make something fantastic out of unexpected materials. And the projects just poured in. In fact, they were so good that we couldn't just pick one winner. We chose three. We loved how Maurice Kenji Clark transformed his Jeep into a rhinoceros and then made a stop-motion animation of it roaming the wilds of Indiana. And 10-year-old Mary Elizabeth Greeley made an ingenious relaxation tub out of a cardboard box filled with hundreds of those otherwise hateful styrofoam packing peanuts.
When you sit in it, your bottom is pretty much on the packing peanuts, and it feels soft, sometimes squishy. If you lie down, it's really comfortable, and if you're small enough, you can hide under the packing peanuts because there's a lot of them.
And last but not least, our third and final winner is, listening in Texas, Francesca McCullough.
Really?
Yes.
That's so exciting. Wow, that's wonderful.
And as an art teacher, that there's something appropriate there.
That is wonderful. My students will be very curious to know about this. It might inspire them even.
Exactly. Francesca made this really gorgeous sculpture inspired by the planetary orbits and the cosmos. It looks like some kind of giant, impeccably constructed nest. And it's made with hot glue and about 25,000 toothpicks.
I love toothpicks. I love wood. I'm completely fascinated by anything that comes as a raw material that I can use. So toothpicks are just easy, but I started 15 years ago. and I can't seem to get out of the habit. I'm stuck in it.
Really? So this is your medium, like it or not, I guess, at this
yes,
point.
Yes, my addiction.
And when do you work on your art? Weekends, nights?
I do about 6 hours a night, and on the weekends about 14.
But is your long-term notion to do less teaching and more art?
Yes, but I do love teaching. I get very excited teaching young ones anything about what I love in the art. It makes me come alive.
Well, thank you very much, and congratulations.
Yes, well, thank you as well. This is very exciting.
Francesca's next project, a sculpture containing 6 million toothpicks. Thanks again to everybody who submitted their projects. You are an inspired and inspiring creative community. You can see every one of the entries at our new and improved studio360.org. And that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Julia Botero,
Sarah Dalia,
Mary Du.
Special thanks to the Museum of Modern Art Archive. And thanks, as ever, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time, Studio 360 takes the stage. Actress Martha Plimpton, novelist Juno Diaz, and singer-songwriter Josh Ritter will join me and a live audience in New York City.
Golden ratio, the shell. Stairs ascending round themselves.
That's next time in Studio 360. From PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.